Hi, Dick.
Environment Natural Resources Committee will come to order. Members, we've got a full day ahead of us, so if we could come to order, I would sure appreciate it. Let me just talk about process a little bit. We're going to hear, we're going to get a little bit of background from Senate Research on some dedicated funding proposals, and then he's going to run through a comparison of the five bills that we have. And then the individual authors of the bills are going to present their bill for them. Senator Pogemiller is ill today, so I believe Senator Cohen is going to be presenting for him. And then after, we're not going to take public testimony during those bills. We're going to go have each author present their bills, and then we will take testimony as listed on the agenda from whoever wants to testify. This is the list that we have. Does the public have the agenda? This is the list we have. We've had a couple of requests from citizens since then, and we'll do our best to get everyone in. There's a chance that we're going to have to spill over into Monday because we've got such an aggressive list here of witnesses. But I do want to make sure everyone is heard on the issue and has their opportunity to speak speak on the issue. I would ask witnesses to try and make sure their comments are not repetitive. Whatever you can do to add on or expound on other people's comments, we would certainly appreciate that. And, of course, brevity is always appreciated in this committee. And then we're going to look to – what we're going to look to do is pass a bill out of this committee on Monday. What I've suggested is that – with the input of the members of this committee, I'm going to put together a delete all amendment. And I'm going to try and have that ready by Friday. But if I'm not, I'm at the very least I'm going to make sure that there's time for the members and the public to review that. And then we're going to then work off of that delete all so that we can pass one bill out of this committee. And then members, that'll give an opportunity for stakeholders if they want to encourage amendments with the members, they can do that. Members can offer amendments at that time. So the process is kind of like a little mini omnibus bill, similar to what we've seen in other committees. The difference is that there will be a lot more lead time for people to review this. And offer their comments, and so I want to make sure that that's open as possible. But I really think there's going to be mass confusion if we end up passing out five different bills to different committees, and those five different bills are proceeding through the process. So this is one way to narrow our focus, and folks can focus their comments and their lobbying and their discussion and their amendments on one Senate file. That's what I had. Any other discussion before we go on to Greg Knopf? Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, you asked me to go over the Missouri plan. You'll see a memo that I wrote to you in the packet for all the members. What I did was just give a brief background on how the Missouri plan was created. It goes back to 1936. I won't read everything I've written here, but there was a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 1936 that created the Conservation Commission. It's four members appointed by the governor to staggered six-year terms, and they manage the Missouri Conservation Department or Department of Conservation. Then in the early 70s, as a result of budget issues for the department, a group was formed to begin a petition. Well, actually, first of all, they looked at this design for conservation, and they were looking at various ways of increasing funding for the department, and they came up with this plan for a sales tax. And they apparently in Missouri, you can get a constitutional amendment on the ballot by petition, and they were able to get enough signatures on it to get it on the 1976 ballot, and it did pass by 51% Missouri, placing 1/8 of 1% in new sales tax revenue on the ballot. And what it did was it passed by 51% of the voters, and it was for fish, wildlife, and forestry, which is basically the jurisdiction of that agency. In Missouri, they have a separate Department of Natural Resources that covers kind of the remainder of our natural resource functions, plus what would in this state would be the Pollution Control Agency. Currently, they receive about $99 million a year from that 1/8 of 1% within Missouri, and it does fund most of their Department of Conservation. They do get some money from Fish and Wildlife, or fishing and hunting license sales and other sources, including federal money. But the bulk of the money for the agency is from that, and you'll notice that about their budget of $176 million for 2006. About $90 million is spent on personnel, another $48 million in operating expenses. So it is most of the money does appear to go for basic operations. As I understand it, that agency does not receive any general fund money in Missouri. And I've also attached a copy of the constitutional provision to that. If you have any questions related to that, I'd be happy to answer those. Otherwise, I just wanted to give the chairman asked me just to give a general overview of what happened in Missouri and how they got to where they are today.
Any questions? You want to go through the comparisons?
And again, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I won't go through in detail, but I did work on a comparison, and then also attached to the back from Mr. Mueller, fiscal analyst for this area. It shows the revenue streams as a result of each of the bills. I won't go through the individual comparisons, but what this does is it compares characteristics of each of the bills. You know, what is the percentage, the length of time, the source, the purposes for which it can be used, and I highlighted the percentage where it's spelled out in the Constitution, and in one bill it's not. And then also the appropriation requirements, just to be clear with people, in the bottom of page one, that all of the bills require an appropriation of the money by the legislature. This does not give money to groups of without going through the legislative process in any of the bills. And then if you look at, on page two, each of the bills creates funds within the constitutional amendment. Some of the bills do prohibit supplanting existing funds. It's a little bit different how each of them work. There's also, in two of the bills, there is allowance for the sale of general obligation bonds for the purposes in Senator Anderson's, Senator Saxhog's bill. And the important point on that is that it would allow for a sale of bonds with a simple majority, because it would be under a different part of the Constitution and not under the one that funds improvements to public acquisition and improvements to public lands and buildings. There's also a requirement for lands to be open to taking fish and game. That's in some of the bills. There's also allocating the Heritage Enhancement Fund, which is mentioned in four of the five bills. And then if you look on page three, there's information on how the Clean Water Fund would be allocated. One bill has a statutory requirements. Three use the existing Clean Water Council. One creates a new Clean Water Council. And then there's also language on parks and trails, statutory allocation of the money within the Parks and Trails Fund. You'll see that I think the first three bills are similar in how they're allocated. In the last bill, Senator Saxhog's, it's a little bit different. There's a new category called easements on grant and aid trails. It's a piece of the other ones, but it's kind of buried within a bigger one. This would provide a specific money just for that purpose. There's also a requirement. Excuse me, I'm going backwards. And then if you look on the fourth page, yeah, there we are, fourth page. Actually, we need to go to the fifth. We got the Arts and Humanities Fund. That's also the statutory allocation within two of the bills. Three of the bills have money for arts, humanities, and public broadcasting, and two of them don't. And then the last one is there's a Forest Legacy Fund within the Saxhog bill that does not contain any others, so there's some information there, except that there is no specific statutory allocation for that. And then on the back you'll see As I mentioned earlier, the information from Mr. Mueller. And just a note, that the number we are using is $194 million generally for the first fiscal year. Now, the way this works is the first year you only get 11 months of payments because there's a month lag in the way the sales tax is collected. So it probably wouldn't be a full 194 in the first year. I think it's like 179, and it'd be a little bit more in the second year than the 194. But this was just a rough approximation at the time when this was being put together. We do have a new revenue note on it, but it's like I said, it'd be a little bit lower in fiscal year 2010, a little higher in fiscal year 2011. But this provides a general overview of an approximation of the money that would be received. Again, if the sales tax goes up over time, as it normally does, it would also increase the amounts that would go to each of these entities or each of these programs. And, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions, that's it.
Thank you. No questions. We'll proceed with the presentation, and we're going to start with Senate File Number 20, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Mr. Knopf kind of summarized the particulars of the bills, and I think he did a good job with that. I think maybe today I'd just like to set the tone for our dedicated funding discussion. In my opening remarks in our first committee hearing, I talked a lot about the importance of the environment, my passion for the outdoors, from camping at the Mississippi headwaters to hunting pheasants in Tracy, Minnesota, from the cabin on the lakeshore to strolling through the Como Zoo, from canoeing the Boundary Waters and biking the Munger Trail to wading the Root River for trout, from the ice house on Mille Lacs to the duck marshes of Windham. Minnesota's outdoor heritage is matched by no other. And I want to keep it that way. I want to keep it that way. I firmly believe that every Minnesotan deserves the freedom to seek the spiritual, creative, and intellectual renewal that nature can provide. And in that endeavor, we have to learn that there is no difference between the environmentalist and the hunter, that preserving the environment can create more jobs than destroying it, and that we all benefit from clean water and more habitat. We all have a voice. So to that end, we've introduced legislation in this committee early on in this session regarding dedication of a portion of our sales tax to wildlife, clean water, and our parks and trails, and others have also introduced legislation that includes the arts, the humanities, and historical societies, as well as, I believe, public radio. Whatever this committee and this legislature decides, I feel the time is right to take this important step to ensure Minnesota's resources are there for future generations to enjoy. We need to act now. We need to act now to ensure that Minnesotans are never denied what we and our forefathers have enjoyed as part of this great state's natural wonders. By introducing and considering this bill early in the 2000 session, we can send a clear message that we are serious about natural resource funding, and that after 10 years of this legislation in the process, we intend to get it done. I've introduced this Senate File 20 that seeks to do that. But why do we need a dedicated source of funding to education, to environment in our Constitution? Well, I've been here for 10 years, and over the past 10 years, the environmental spending from the state's general fund is no greater than 1% of our general fund over 10 years in just my presence alone in this legislature. Priorities such as education, property tax relief, health care funding are all large parts of Minnesota's budget already. And that is as it should be. That's as it should be. But when we look on each and every one of our license plates that says land of 10,000 lakes, when we look and see the walleye splashing out of the water, the deer on the license plates. We give the impression that Minnesota is committed to the environment. And I believe that 1% of our state's general fund is simply not enough to make that impression the truth. To make that impression the truth. And so while we are considering uses of our surplus dollars, whatever amount that is, $1 billion in one time, tens of millions in permanent, or whatever, it's too easy. It's too easy for the environment to fall down the totem pole. And I'm not just saying that because I've been here for 10 years and I've seen that. And it's not because anyone is bad. That's just the way it's been. But with issues that we are grappling with on a state, national, and worldwide level, such as global warming and other important issues like clean water, like the loss of our habitats, our rare and endangered species, we don't have time. We don't have time. And so that's why I believe we need a dedicated funding source in our Constitution, because this is fundamentally what Minnesota is about, our natural resources. We don't have Disneyland. We don't have the Golden Gate Bridge. We don't have, we don't have other things that attract tourists worldwide to our state. But we do have our natural resources, our boundary waters, our parks, our trails, our state forests. All of those things are critical not only to the vitality of our environment, but the vitality to our economy. Vitality to our economy. And we can preserve our natural resources and grow our economy at the same time. And I think this is the type of investment that we're making, not only in the, not just in quality of life issues, such as the ability to go camping or go play in a park. Minnesota's natural resources go far beyond that. Minnesota's environment is a necessity of our life. Our environment is a necessity of our life. Our water that we drink, the air that we breathe, and the jobs that we create are all absolutely dependent upon our environment. So that's why I have proposed Senate File 20. As you can tell, it's an issue that's very important to me, that we get this done, that we get this done this session. I'm not the first to propose this legislation. I have a lot of wonderful work has been done previous to my involvement directly in dedicated funding. We're going to hear from some of those people today. But I thank the committee for their attention, and I think in the interest of time, we'll move on to the other presenters. Unless there are other questions.
Questions for Senator Chaudhry?
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, Senator Cohen, welcome to the committee. You're going to present for Senator Pogermiller as well as your bill. Which would you like to start with?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the chance to be here. I think what I'd like to do is just present both bills at the same time because they're basically the same. The difference with Senator Pogermiller's bill is that it has a higher amount specified for the sales tax as opposed to my Senate File 37. And Senator Pogemiller is ill today and not in the building, so he had asked me to present his bill for him. Mr. Chairman, let me begin by indicating that I concur in totality with the remarks you made and the importance of the preservation, enhancement, and protection of our natural resources and the importance that they play in the state of Minnesota. I do want to start out by indicating, though, that I think I'd be remiss in appearing before this committee at this time. Mr. Chairman, you indicated, obviously, your strong interest in these issues and your support for this effort in the past. Glancing around the table, I think the people who have been most involved with this in the last go-around were Senator Frederickson, Senator Saxhog, and myself, in our assistance to Senator Sams, who has been the person in this Senate who has carried this legislation the last several years. And whatever happens this year will be a tribute to the work that he has done prior to this, because it was Dallas who has been the strongest advocate in the state Senate for the last number of years relative to this issue. And as members recall, Senator Sams passed his bill last year off the floor of the Senate with a significant majority vote, indicating broad support, I believe, for the legislation that I bring to this committee and that Senator Pogemiller brings to this committee, because we modeled our bills in totality, separate from the dollar amount, off the Senator Sams bill that passed off the Senate floor. And that bill obviously also includes support for the preservation and revitalization of Minnesota's artistic and cultural resources. Mr. Chairman, you indicated the importance to Minnesota of our natural resources, both internal and external to Minnesota. And I think the same argument can be made relative to the artistic and cultural resources of Minnesota. I think the things that make Minnesota unique are its natural resources and its artistic and cultural resources. That's what attracts people to Minnesota who don't live here. That's what's utilized by millions of people within Minnesota. And those are the areas of Minnesota life, the quality of life, that makes a difference to people both within and without the state. And I think the same kinds of arguments that can be made relative to what's happened financially in terms of support for the natural resources can be made in the case of my legislation as well. Certainly both areas have been significantly underfunded. Both areas stand to be at great risk in terms of continuing to provide that quality of life to citizens of Minnesota. You'll have the chance to hear from an impressive group of witnesses in regard to all of these issues that can talk in more detail to the committee about the importance of this combination. And so I hope that whatever this committee and the State Senate does this year, that it'll include the enhancement, revitalization, protection, conservation of Minnesota's quality of life in totality. And we'll do so in a way that will ensure that Minnesota's legacy for future generations will be protected, and the kinds of problems that have been taking place at all levels will, if not be stopped, will certainly be will be stopped, and hopefully will go back to the Minnesota of X number of years ago. Let me, Mr. Chairman, because I know you have a number of witnesses who are more important to listen to than myself, let me make a comment about the process. Mr. Chairman, you indicated your feeling that you'd like to pass one bill out of this committee, and I would concur in that. I was going to suggest that my bill be laid over. Now, if a decision on the part of the committee is to pass all bills, obviously I want my bill included in that. It is my suggestion that Senate File 6 be the vehicle for the committee, the bill authored by the Majority Leader of the Senate. And Senator Pogemiller and I have talked about this at length, and we feel that the appropriate bill to pass is Senate File 6. And obviously, at the end of the day, we can only pass one bill off the Senate floor. Senate File 6 is a bill that is part of the package put together by Senator Pogemiller. There are several other issues involved. And I would hope this committee, if it's going to consider one bill, would consider that as the appropriate vehicle. The second thing I want to mention relative to process is that I hope that this committee will have a serious discussion about what is appropriate in terms of doing what's right for Minnesotans and the Minnesota quality of life. But obviously the other committees have their jurisdictions. It's my understanding that from this committee, the bill would go to Senator Rest Policy Committee, which would be the committee that would deal with the organizational structures within the proposed legislation. The Finance Committee will make the determination as to the amount of money and how it's to be spent, and the division of the resources within whatever bill is in front of the Finance Committee. And it would be my intent to hear one bill, and my intent would be to hear Senator Pogemiller's bill at this juncture. There might be some further discussion about that, but that would be my intent. The Tax Committee would have the determination as to what ought to be done in terms of a particular tax or the amount of that tax, and the Rules Committee would make the determination as to what the ballot language ought to look like. Again, Senator Pogemiller is not here today to present some of that as well, but he and I have, again, had a lot of conversation about this effort, and that's the recommendation we would like to make to the committee in terms of how to handle things procedurally. So, Mr. Chairman, again, I understand that you have a number of people to testify and other authors here would like to present their ideas, but most importantly, to listen to the people from the public as to what's going on. So appreciate the chance to be here, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Senator Cohen? Senator Sieben?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Cohen, I just, as the chair of the Finance Committee, I'm interested in your opinion or your insight into all the bills seem to have some sort of language that specifies that funds generated from whatever bill passes cannot be used as substitute for future funding. And as the chair of the Finance Division, I'm just curious any insight or how that would be handled in the future, or what can be done to ensure that that does not happen, that money generated by the dedication does not in some way in future years become a substitution for traditional funding.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, as you know, and I think most members of the committee recognize, this legislature can't bind future sessions of the state legislature. Depending on what kind of ballot language is put on the ballot and depending on what's actually placed in the Constitution, there might be some protection in that regard. Certainly, I think if people in Minnesota vote in support of this legislation, that's going to be a pretty strong message to future legislatures. But I can't tell you for a certainty as to what a legislature 25 years from now is going to do.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cohen, I understand that it's just curious, I think, how it specifies in the bill that it shall not be a substitute for traditional funding sources. So that's sort of where I was.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, let me piggyback on comments made by the chairman. We're talking about areas that have been underfunded, areas that are heavily utilized but underfunded. And I think in many of these areas within the legislation, you know, if you take a look at, the DNR budget and how far the Game and Fish Fund is able to go or not go, it's going to be difficult to say, okay, we've got this additional money, and that supplants the money that historically has been used. The reality is that if we're going to do this right, we would need both sources of funding. And I think it's incumbent upon future legislatures to keep that in mind. But I think depending on the legislation passed, that message can be delivered.
I think Senator Vickerman was next.
Now, this is just a statement. You know, we sat here and we look at all how nice this is, and I'm going to vote for one of these. But don't forget a group of people that gives us the chance to do that. And those are the veterans that's sitting and put their life on the line over there for us so that we can enjoy these great things. I need to find $75 million to help get that through. I'm going to try to get that some way. But just remember, without our National Guard and our soldiers, I don't care what you pass, we couldn't hunt and fish here anyway. That's a freedom that we all enjoy. Now I want to put you on notice that I am going to find money for those veterans. I'm going to vote for this, but it's got to tie in with what we do with our veterans that are working, putting their life on the line, men and women, over there so we can enjoy our hunting and fishing and that group. So just a statement, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chairman,
well said.
I recognize Senator Vickerman is not looking necessarily for a response, but I just want to concur in his remarks. And Senator Vickerman and I have talked about this, and he knows that when we set targets for his division, I'm going to keep in mind and attempt to set a target for Senator Vickerman's division that will protect that part of Minnesota's quality of life, you know, what the vets and servicemen have offered our state.
Senator Ingebrigtsen was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also would just like to make a comment what Senator Sieben was saying about our concern about this money being dedicated and always being dedicated for what it says in the statute. And I understand that it can't be nailed down to future legislative sessions. However, I just want to make a comment in regards to the scratch off. Some years ago, we all voted on that. We all thought the old money was going to be going to the environment, and that at that time, I guess we all believed it was. However, I know only 40% of that is going into the Environmental Trust Fund, and some of the rest of that money is actually going into the general fund. And I think, quite frankly, the majority of the voters that I represent out there think all that money is going to the environment. So I just want to make a comment that we need to be a little more straightforward in some of the dollars that are being spent here to make sure that if, in fact, there are some additional dollars that are going to be taxed under local taxpayers here in the state of Minnesota, that they actually stay there and actually go towards what the new statute calls for and the amendment calls for. Just a point of concern.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, one of the reasons that I decided to introduce a bill, one of the five bills, I think we have five total, correct, is that I didn't think so far that yours and Senator Pogemiller's bills adequately dealt with the issue of clean water. And I think all the experts out in Minnesota and the advocacy groups and the public consider that a very high priority, and I think they've made it clear that the dollar amount that's really needed to do the job is in the $100 million range. And so I guess what I want to ask is if you are asking us to support Senator Pogemiller's bill, I need to know that that will be a higher priority than is expressed in the original bill, because I don't think it's given adequate support.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, that's why I made clear that I think it's within the province of the Finance Committee to try to take a look at those numbers and determine what works. And obviously, you're a member of the Finance Committee, and so you'll be a participant in those conversations so that we can determine in terms of the various allocations proposed that it's actually going to do the job and to take a close look at what's proposed in that regard.
Well,
follow up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I'm not sure that's quite satisfies me enough, because I don't know if there's one bill that passes out of this committee, is it going to have blanks or is it going to have dollar amounts? And, you know, I just want to know if I'm going to give up ownership of this bill to some other authors, I want to know that they are as committed on this issue, that it's not just going to be up to – I mean, obviously the committee has to – have a process, and the full Senate gets to vote on this. But I'm interested in knowing from yours or Senator Pogemiller's perspective that it's a high priority and that there will be a focus on trying to make that a bigger portion of the pie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, certainly I would agree that the proposal relative to clean water is, in all honesty, the political driver within this legislation. And in a variety of you know, my present chairmanship and previous chairmanships, I've had the opportunity to wrestle with the issue of what's needed, and we know that has been tremendously underfunded. Now, in terms of what the amount is, I can't tell you that. The process in this Senate for every year I've been here is that the Finance Committee, whether a bill comes with blank appropriations or comes with an appropriation amount specified out of a policy committee, that's the province of the Finance Committee. And so I can't tell you, I can't predict what the Finance Committee is going to do. Knowing the makeup of that committee as I do, I assume that's going to be very, very important to the committee. And I can look around this table, I know that's the case. I know Senator Frederickson has been one of the leaders, has authored the CREP legislation as well as other legislation. And Senator Frederickson is on the Finance Committee. You're on the Finance Committee. I think Senator Olson remains on the Finance Committee. Oh, okay. Senator Olson's no longer on the Finance Committee. I'm sorry to hear that, Senator Olson. We haven't met yet as a committee. So, Mr. Chairman, certainly two members of this committee will be participants in the Finance Committee process. But, Senator Anderson, that's the way it's always worked with any appropriation bill of any sort.
Okay. Is there any further question for Senator Cohen? Thank you very much.
Chairman, members, thank you.
Senator Anderson, would you like to go next?
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. The bill that I have chief authored is Senate File 137. And I guess I would start by saying I really appreciate the comments that you made, Mr. Chair, at the beginning of your presentation. And I don't intend to try to repeat the speech that you made, but I think you articulated well the values that we all hold as Minnesotans and that we hold very dear in this state, and that is motivating all of us, I think. And so that's really important that we all have that in common. And I've, over the last number of years, I've certainly supported Senator Sam's bill, but I have to admit that I've sat a little bit on the sidelines, and that as since being appointed budget chair, which is only a short time ago, I've kind of gotten a new perspective on this issue. Because I've started to think a little more carefully about how to pay for the things that are covered in the environment and natural resources areas. And I'm realizing that, I mean, even though I believe very strongly that it's our obligation as a state to preserve and protect our natural resources, and I think that the citizens of Minnesota expect that from their state government, that that's part of our role is to do that. Or to help the citizens do that. But I think I've heard some things that have really compelled me to believe that we are in danger of losing so much of what we treasure in this state unless we act now, and that it will be difficult, even in the best of budget years, to get adequate support to do that within the constraints of a normal state budget. And so I guess that's why I have become a more avid supporter of the idea of a dedicated funding proposal. And as I mentioned to Senator Cohen a moment ago, I also was motivated to introduce this bill because I believe that the clean water portion of this is such a critical, important aspect of the bill. I think it's probably, of all the issues that we talk about in this committee and in all of these bills, it's the one that probably matters the most to the people of our state. And as Senator Cohen mentioned, it can help politically drive this issue at the ballot box, but that's not really why it's important. It's important because we all need water to live, and we know what a treasure that is in Minnesota and what a unique treasure it is. And that, along with and so I don't think that the other bills that were introduced have an put enough priority into the area of clean water. So I really want to emphasize that again. And as we go through and figure out what the process will be with moving these bills forward, I think all of the senators that are involved in trying to pass this do need to be very, very clear that that's a priority. And that's what I will continue to do. Another fact that, and you're going to hear all this great testimony from people that can say this much better than I can, but another fact that's really captured my attention recently is understanding that, and I think John Curry will probably talk about this, that we're in danger of losing 1 million acres of open space in the next couple of decades in Minnesota. And we've all heard the figure that we can expect something like 1 million more people in the metropolitan area by the year 2020 or 2025 in this state. And so I think those two things are going at the same pace. They're driving each other. And that concerns me very, very greatly and has really led me to think about this in a new way, because we've heard for years from the hunters and anglers about the need to have habitat protection, to restore wetlands. And a lot of that focus has been more in the undeveloped parts of the state or in the rural parts of the state, not as much in the metropolitan area. And it's, I think all of these factors are coalescing together. And they should, because as we say often, we're one Minnesota. And if you put all of those different issues together. You have the land and water issues that will affect all of our population in the generations to come. And so I think those are critical reasons why we need to move forward in this area. I just want to mention a couple of other features that make this bill different. Oh, and by the way, I think Senator Saxhog's bill that he introduced after mine, I believe, also includes $100 million for water protection. And I was really glad to. Is that true? Am I wrong? Okay, depends how you add it up. Anyway, I think I just wanted to acknowledge that. But I think that's a huge priority, and I think that's got to be one of the leading issues that's driving this bill. Parks and trails is another area where I think we have fallen down on the job, and we haven't protected those adequately with our state funding in the last number of years. And those are an asset that will be around, again, for generations. So this is not – I can understand why the proponents of this legislation have talked about these issues, land and water and parks protection, as part of our legacy. These are part of our legacy so that we know that our children and our grandchildren will have opportunities to participate and enjoy our natural resources for years and years to come. And I certainly am supportive of investment in our cultural heritage in the arts and museums as well. The other things in this bill that are unique are that I did remove the councils, and my bill is sort of drafted kind of as an outline. It kind of gives some areas of priority, but it doesn't flesh out all the details. And it leaves blank amounts for habitat protection, parks, and the arts. And I think those are items that are yet to be determined about where, how to divide up the pie. And that's something we need to have a vigorous debate about. And one of the this bill also includes the approach of using bonding dollars to acquire land and set it aside. And some of that, I think, can be used also for water protection. And I think that's a good approach because it helps to leverage the dollars and make them go further. And I also know that all those advocacy groups that are all around us today that have worked so hard on these issues for years and years and will continue to do this, to be the ones on the ground who are doing, making a lot of this come to fruition, that they support that approach as well. And so this bill does reflect a lot of the work that has been put into this by the coalition that's brought this bill together. I mentioned I took out the councils because I think it's something to have some discussion about. What's the best way of spending these dollars? Frankly, I think kind of a citizen-legislator hybrid like the LCCMR might be a good approach. But I think we should take a fresh look at these ideas. What I've been saying in the last month or so about these bills is that I think we really do need to find a stronger consensus. And I think in the Senate over the last few years, we've had more of that consensus. But with Senator Sams gone, it seems like that's gone from the Senate. That consensus has kind of split apart a little bit. And so with five different bills, and in the House, goodness knows what they're thinking because they have such a different cast of characters involved now who will be leading the charge, who may take an entirely different approach. So we really don't know where this is headed. So I think it's important for all of us to try to take a step back and figure out how to find a consensus on putting all of these assets, these natural resource assets and cultural assets that we value so much into kind of one pot that we can have a consensus for those of us from all different parts of the state to support. And I think that's how we're going to be successful on the ballot with the voters as well. And I think that's all I want to say about it. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Anderson, just so I'm clear, you're talking $100 million for clean water, and then the rest of the pie, you don't really have a preference how that pie is divided up?
I'm open, I would say. And I think we're going to have a very vigorous debate about, especially if Senator Pogemiller's bill moves forward. His has a total dollar amount. His makes the pie bigger. And so his is at 3/8 of a cent. The others, I believe, are at 1/4 of a cent. It depends on how much money is available. I think that habitat protection and land protection are absolutely critical. I think parks and trails are absolutely critical. And I support adequate funding for the cultural resources. So I don't know exactly what those dollar amounts should be, but I want to support all of them.
Just a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We heard the possibility of a delete all and then a bringing together of the good ideas. I could tell you weren't real pleased with Senator Pogamiller or Senator Cohen necessarily on how they presented theirs, already slicing the pie. Are you willing to think about bringing pieces of all of them together, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think those are excellent questions. I'm willing to work within whatever process this committee and the leadership of the Senate chooses. So whatever we decide to do in terms of the process, I can work within those restrictions. But my concern is that the big gap in those bills, as I see it, is adequate. The one piece of this that I know the dollar amount that we need is clean water. And I know that's $100 million. That's the number that I think everybody agrees on is needed. And so I would like to hear a commitment that we're going to try to do that. Beyond that, I'm very open to discuss and negotiate the other pieces of this bill.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I apologize that I haven't studied the statutes that some of these pieces are coming from. For example, I notice it's current law that addressing the deposit of revenues that breaks out the 50% of receipts are deposited in a heritage enhancement account in the Game and Fish Fund. And then we've got 22.5% for the Natural Resources Fund, 22.5% for the Natural Resources Fund for that's the parks and trails stuff and the grants in your law. But when I go back to the new language, you've got a Great Outdoors account that I don't see anything going to. I don't know what that division that I just described in current law is applying to. You're dedicating $100 million, and you've got a blank that appears that you want to dedicate $100 million for clean water, and you want to dedicate an amount for the arts and humanities. So what's left over after you make those two decisions is what will go into this Great Outdoors account, which I don't find anywhere.
You know, I'm going to ask counsel, because I had the same question about the statutory language that's already in here, I think, is just carried along in her drafting. But maybe she can help answer where the Great Outdoors account, where the blank is for that.
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it actually does set up, in Section 3, it sets up a Great Outdoors account by just saying one is established as an account within the bigger fund. And you're right, since there is no blank for it and no set amount, it gets the leftover amount. And the language I think that you're referring to in Section 5, that's current law, that's out of the tax code, and it's a provision that we just made one small technical change in on line 3.7 to the provision itself tells the Commissioner of Finance where to put monies, and this current language has nothing to do with the language of the constitutional amendment. Lottery.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Baker, this distribution is what applies to the lottery funds?
The lottery in lieu?
Lottery in lieu tax. It's the amount of money that the lottery tickets don't have to actually be sold with a tax attached, but the lottery pays the lottery in lieu tax, which is the amount of the sales tax that they would have basically charged on the gross amount of lottery tickets. And then that money is distributed this way. And so that's current law. The only reason this section's in here is because we needed to make a small technical change at the top of it on page 3, line 7. That would tell them not to put any sales increase comes from the Minnesota Constitution article
11, Section 15.
Which is this.
In here.
Which is.
To, right. So I'm saying
Speaker,
except
that's,
for that,
that's
this is how you.
If this passes, that's the designation, and that won't go into it.
Right. 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 And that will, none of this would become effective unless the constitutional amendment does get adopted.
And so Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, what kind of projection do you have for the amount of revenue, at least at first blush or in the current status, that would be generated by the amount of tax that you have in your amendment, 1/4 of 1%?
Mr. Chair, let me start by going back to your first question. I apologize about there should be a blank here for the Great Outdoors account. There should be a minimum blank there, too, just because I'm not – it should be equated in the same importance as these other items that are in here. So I probably didn't convey that to council. So,
Ms. Baker?
I don't
– Mr. Chair, let me point out one other thing in that Section 3 that – off the very top comes any amount that needs to be paid to service the bond debt if bonds are sold to finance any of this. That's the very first thing. And then, so you can't, it's not maybe going to work out to be perfect percentages.
There's, and Mr. Chair, there's a spreadsheet sitting out in my spot there. And if a page could maybe bring me that, I could try to answer Senator Olson's question. It's in. I'm going to need my glasses, too. It's a – and I don't know. Was this passed out to the committee? Yeah. I know that I think Mr. Mueller made this.
Yeah,
it's a
Knopf.
Thank you. Or maybe council did. Thank you. This is a – we have a side-by-side, and maybe we have that.
Yeah.
Do the committee
Mr.
members
Knopf.
Have that? It's a comparison of the five bills.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, on the back of the comparison of the five bills that was in your packet, on the very back there's a spreadsheet for Mr. Mueller that shows each bill and how much revenue it raises and how it's split out.
Can I have that, please? That's the one I need. Sorry. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head.
So Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I see that it raises $194 million. Now, if you're going to establish minimums for each of those, obviously you want to give priority to the clean water.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens? Do you have provision for prorating? What happens if we don't get that much money coming in? Then
well,
we have designated in statute that we're going to have a minimum of this amount. So when you do that by set dollar amounts, isn't that rather difficult to manage?
Mr. Chair, again, that was a drafting decision, and it doesn't have to be drafted that way. I think all the bills say a certain – are all the bills drafted as a percent rather than a dollar amount, all the other provisions?
Yes.
So
it looks
like
this
is what you're getting at. You know, we could certainly account for that by saying that if that dollar amount is not collected, then we'd have to change the allocation and there'd have to be a pro rata reduction. But I think that we can also have fairly good estimates and of our tax revenues from the sales tax, but of course they're never exact. And
so,
it would be pretty shocking if they would get below $100 million.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I thought you said you were going to establish the minimums for all three. Right now, the 100, if you were going to translate into percentages and base it on the current income, you'd probably be looking at about 50, I'm just guessing 55%, but over 50% would be going to clean water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you haven't given us any indication with the blank what percentage you were saying, but you had a designated blank, would go to the arts. So that's why I was trying to reach some kind of relationship as to between those three areas, how you were seeing this money go. I think that percentage is you'd almost have to do that if we weren't going to get in the trouble of trying to deal with set dollar amounts for something that is not is a floating kind of number, both up or down. So I would be interested in knowing what your how you would see that relationship in terms of the water, the great outdoors, and the arts. in terms of percentage.
That's right. Okay.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. The when you issue bonds with a lot of this money, what you do is triple or double or triple. And what we have here is a projection of $319 million per year that would be available to use based on the projection of $194 million of sales tax revenue. So it would leverage that much in bonding. So that's part of the answer. So it's a higher amount than it looks like. But, Senator Olson, I think you're asking what are my priorities after the clean water and whether it would it be a percentage or a dollar amount? Is that what I'm hearing you ask?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, you're kind of confusing the issue with bonding. The reality is that we're still dealing with the proceeds of the tax. Okay, you're linking the two, the tax receipts and the proceeds of bonds.
And Senator Olson, we're going to hear more about this bonding aspect with other witnesses that can explain in more detail.
Yeah, I think we need some understanding of that because if you're talking about the sales tax and how it's apportioned between funds, that's one thing. And then if that sales tax can also those proceeds can be used to pay off bonds, I'm not sure if that's what you're saying or you're just saying but the proceeds bonds can be sold and put in there, but the proceeds in that fund coming from the sales tax, I presume, are going to help pay off bonds.
I presume that's how it would work, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. And so
it just means
the dollar amount is expanded beyond
the
immediate cash flow from the sales tax.
But, Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, that's a decision of how you decide to use the funds from the sales tax, is to leverage more or spend them outright in the, quote, the pay-as-you-go versus bonding issue. And I see that as somewhat separate. It can illustrate how you can leverage it. But I think it's still the apportionment between these three categories that we do need to understand and is a policy decision.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I really generally support the percentages that were in Senator Sam's bill in general, but I just don't think that the water amount is adequate. And so I think that, but I can't tell you exactly what those dollar amounts are off the top of my head. To add them up to the right, to come out to the right number, when you add in the leveraging that, and some items are bondable and some aren't. I'm going to let the advocacy groups that have proposed this idea of using bonding help to answer that question because I'm not prepared to do that. I just wanted to give
detail.
A broad outline. I mean, I support the rough proportion that was in Senator Sam's bill, very roughly, let's just say that.
Good.
That's
Thank
about
you.
As best as I can answer it at the moment.
Thank you. Further questions for Senator Anderson? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator Anderson.
Thank you.
Senator Saxog.
Well,
210.
Last, but hopefully not least, Mr. Chair. Today I'm presenting Senate File 210, the Saxog Outdoor Heritage Amendment. If it pleases the Chair for the first time here, I'm going to have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move to put the bill in the shape that I need.
Okay. Senator Saxog moves the A1. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Knopf for putting this particular piece together and to help us understand the difference between and the similarities between the five bills. And, Mr. Chair, I certainly sympathize with your feelings on natural resources in the state of Minnesota and how important they are. And I guess, lastly, as my acknowledgments here, I'd like to acknowledge and thank Senator Lessard and Senator Sams and absentia for the work they've done in the past on this particular subject. This particular bill takes 0.25% new sales tax And as you see on the back, it's about it would raise approximately $195 million. Senate File 210 has many similarities to the other bills that were being presented today. It does differ in a couple of very important ways. The main difference, I would say, is to use part of the dedicated funding to preserve the integrity and access of Minnesota forests. This will also protect the largest unpolluted aquifer in the lower 48 states, that being the area starting about 15 miles north of Mora and working its way up 65 and spreading out to the border. As I've expressed to the committee before, at one point it wasn't the largest unpolluted aquifer in the United States, lower 48. The Florida Everglades used to be and no longer is. So I propose that we use a portion of the revenue to keep our healthy, sustainable, multi-use forests intact. I would establish four funds and allocate the money as follows. About 31% would go to the Heritage Fish, Game, Wildlife Habitat Enhancement Fund. It's similar to the ones that Senator Pogemiller and Senator Cohen have in their bill. Secondly, about 31% would go to the Clean Water Fund. Approximately 20% would go to Parks and Trails. I have something a little different embedded in there. I would take 13% of that 20% and have it go to permanent easements for grant and aid trails, state of Minnesota. Somebody, one of the presenters already talked a little bit, I think it was Senator Anderson, about the importance of trails and keeping them from being fragmented. And lastly, probably most important, about 18%, or a new category called the Forest Legacy Fund for the acquisition of forest land or the acquisition of permanent conservation easements on private forest lands. In your packet, members, Mr. Chairman and members, I have two pieces. One, an article in the that came out of the Star Tribune in January of this year, which talked about potlatch and its need to unload 120,000 acres of northern Minnesota forest land. If there was a part of that that the state of Minnesota felt that it would be in their best interest to have, we really don't have any particular way to purchase that land. The second is a plat map. Senator Dibble said he likes colored plat maps, and I think we all do. We find them kind of fascinating. But I did this to show a couple of things. First of all, this is the Track 17 and Track 14 are actual Boise Cascade pieces that are being sold, I think, by the Wilson Group through Cabela's. So this is actually happening. On the right side, upper right, you see four or five sections of land that are owned by Boise Cascade. It wouldn't seem to me to be appropriate for the state of Minnesota to buy this amount of money, this amount of land. But I think that through the forest legacy and our conservation easements, it would be appropriate to obtain a conservation easement so that it would be possible to use this for forestry, use this for recreation. Senator Vickerman, you've spoken several times about your friends who came north to Kuching County to go deer hunting, and the gate was on the land. And that's one of the things we're trying to avoid. But I talked a little bit about the acquisition of forest land and forest land consolidation. The other piece on Section 17 is a piece of Boise land that's embedded in some state and federal land. And I think this would be an appropriate place for possibly the state of Minnesota to purchase that land and keep it intact and keep it from being fragmented. So those are two examples on one township in northern Minnesota, northern Itasca County, that I believe show the possibilities of this particular Forest Legacy Fund. One other thing I would reference you to is line 1.22. That's the point that refers to the bonding. And I guess Senator, Anderson, if I was going to talk about the fact that, you know, maybe I'm at $60 million now, you know, it would be possible with bonding, if you needed more for a project, to maybe raise it to the point that you would think was adequate. And that's the similarity between your bill and my bill, is the ability to bond. It doesn't say you have to bond, but the ability to bond. Well, that, Mr. Chair, I think I've pretty much discussed all I need to in this bill. I would certainly stand for questions.
Questions for Senator Saxog. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I'm still trying to go back to this, and I apologize in my previous questions that I wasn't paying attention to the fact that bonding proceeds were being deposited, and that was considered part of that. Presumably, the bonding decisions are made by the legislature and would be made based on there being proceeds from some other source that would be able to have the capability of paying off those bonds. So it isn't when you direct the commissioner to sell bonds, that's the direction that is given by the legislature with some understanding that it's supportable by the fund and the other source of revenue. Is that a correct understanding, or could you explain how that process will work of how much bonding can in fact be generated, and who makes that decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, as I think I heard you say before, you're going to have X amount of dollars that are generated by the sales tax, and I would just assume that you'd have to figure out what that would retire in terms of debt and work from in that direction. And in terms of back to 1.22, well, that's the part that deals with the bonding. But you know, I think it is true that the legislature needs to appropriate these funds, if I'm reading this correctly.
And your bill says that bonds may be used.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
That's also on there, Senator Olson.
Pardon me?
Bonds may be used.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Under Senator Saxog's bill.
But Mr. Chairman, by what process is that determined?
Well,
Our normal legislative process?
Mr. Knopf.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it would be a sale of bonds through the normal legislative process. So one thing that would happen here is that you would not be required to have a 60% majority vote for bonds. So they could be sold with a simple majority in the legislature. This is a little different from Senator Anderson's bill in that it wouldn't put the proceeds back into those funds. They would be spent for the same purposes as those funds, but the funds could be used as a as payment for the debt service on the bonds. And as you know, if the legislature doesn't appropriate enough money for debt service, there's an automatic property tax that goes into effect on general obligation bonds. So that's kind of how this would work the same way. It would provide a revenue stream, but if the amount fell short, then the legislature would either have to appropriate general fund for it, or they would have to again. And this hasn't happened. It's always that the big hammer kind of behind the scenes that if the legislature doesn't appropriate enough for debt service, the property tax would take effect.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saxog, yours is the only one with Forest Legacy in it. In the past, just to bring me up to speed, has Forest Legacy been talked about in previous bills that this institution has dealt with? I mean, I for one, like that you're talking about the forests, but in years past, have we not had that as part of a bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, I think that the forest legacy and the problems that we witness in looking at both this article and this plat map point to something that's come up just in the last couple of years. I really believe that when Senator Lessard was dealing with this thing originally, Boise Cascade hadn't decided they were going to divest themselves of land, and neither had Potlatch. So this was, you know, this is a relatively new phenomenon and something that we need to deal with.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Saxon, just a point of clarification on your handout. I see these little blotches of little squares, 45, 2 acres, 39 acres on the U.S. property there in the lower right-hand corner. And also the state of Minnesota has some plots there. Are those privately owned, or are they leased from the state? Or just give me an idea what they are.
Mr. Saxon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, you know, specifically some of those are pretty obvious, obviously private patches because they have, or plats because they have names on them. But I'm assuming that it has something to do with the survey if they indeed still are part of the U.S.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, did you have another question, Senator Wilson?
So just a comment. So, Mr. Chairman, I think you and your delete all amendment and Senator Chaudhry have chosen a little different ballot language. Is that the rationale that might be more clearly understood, that 2 cents on $8 is really the same as a quarter of 1%, but we're going to paint the picture a little differently for the voters?
Mr. Chair, why did you do that?
So it wasn't confused with that, just so it would be more clear as to how much that was, as opposed to, you know, when you get into percentages, it can be a little less clear. So that's why we put that on there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. yes, Senator Sherman.
Yes, sorry there was a link today. I'm noticing throughout all of these proposals that when they're talking about the distribution of the dollars, that the distribution between the metro and the rural parks are substantially different. Could you help me understand how you came to those percentages?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Saxon.
Senator Sherman, I basically used the same figures as I believe that Senator Sams did, and I think it was an agreement that was kind of negotiated between the state and the metropolitan parks, and that's how the percentages are the way they are.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just also had just been attending to the beneficiary of previous debates and conversations, both around these bills, these array of bills, and this general issue. The metro parks often serve as the de facto state parks and trails in the metro area. State parks and state trails are, by and large, metro parks. I think so the non-metro parks and trails are non-state parks and non-state trails outside of the metro. So if you look up at state parks and state trails, varying amounts, probably 30-some percent and 10-some percent. Not much of that money goes to Greater Minnesota.
You're saying we have very few, if any, state parks in the metro area.
Thank you. And I'm not the lawyer.
Okay, further discussion? Thank you, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We'll move on to the public testimony. First one we have on the agenda is Bob Lassard.
That's in the metro. That's in the Stillwater area. Washington.
Thank you, Mr. We're ready? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Bob Lassard. I was around this body for 26 years, so I used to sit up there and sat down there, and I sat in your seat over there at one time. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I just want to quickly say a little bit to Senator Sachsen about the what's happening in northern Minnesota. That isn't what I was going to talk about, but I'm glad you put that in your bill. Boise Cascade, and I was very surprised when first Boise Cascade was sold to a company out of Illinois, and then they sold the land to Forest Cap, which is a holding company out of Boston. And you're right, what they found out is cheaper to make more money to sell the land and hopefully buy other land for the future. But what's happened is this last sale that we just had up there, be sold on auction. I'm just aware of this now. A piece was sold, and there's a major snowmobile trail that goes through there. And that owner of that can stop that whole system. And that wasn't here what I was going to talk to you about, but I think it's crucial that this legislature recognizes through Forest Legacy or whatever you want to call it, that somehow we try to reach an accommodation with Boise Cascade and Potlatch and Blandon Paper Company and try to identify those lands. We can't buy them all, and I happen to believe in the free enterprise system, and they have the right to sell them. But I understand the department is moving on this, in this direction. But every year they're going to sell off a certain amount more, and I think it's crucial. It's overwhelming. When I look at Boise Cascade, they have about 290,000, and they're not going to sell it all off in one chunk. They're going to sell it off over the years. And I believe this legislature hopefully will look at this and do something with Forest Legacy so we can possibly sit down and find out where we can agree that there's a patch of land here or maybe doing exchanges with them inside and outside national forests and all this type of stuff. That's not what I was here to talk about, but it's huge. It used to be with the mining companies and the paper companies, I carried legislation at one time. They were going to close the usage to us because of product liability. And I carried a bill that exempted the paper companies and the mining companies to allow us to continue to go across their lands if that would give them protection from lawsuits. We passed that piece of legislation. And consequently, we in northern Minnesota, but I think it benefits the whole state, no matter who you are, wherever you went up to, you could go virtually anywhere. And all this paper company land with virtually no trespassing signs or nothing. And if you go to Texas and you see what's happening, what has happened down there, I don't care if you go to Georgia, you go to Alabama, you go to Louisiana, you even go to Wisconsin, we have much more open land. I did a study on this one time, and on the mid-sized states, Minnesota, now this is arguably, but for the same amount of acreage, we had more state land in Minnesota than any other state in the Union. But when you take away the Superior and Chippewa National Forest, you take that out of the mix, it cuts that down considerably. So Senator, I really appreciate you putting this bill. I did not know you were going to have this in this bill. Or maybe we have to do it in some type of bonding proposal. I don't know, but it's crucial. It's that big an issue, and it'll benefit the entire state. And I was, when Senator Anderson, when you were testifying about there might be a marriage that can be made a little bit. I understand what's happening in the Twin Cities. I worked a lot when I was chairing this committee, stuff you probably don't even know, that to help the Twin Cities. So I think there's a possibility of marrying these two approaches, and I just want to bring that up. Now, I don't want to take much more of your time. I introduced this bill many years ago, and we this close to pass it about three different occasions, and I'm more comfortable this year. I think that given all the enthusiasm that we have on both sides of the aisle and the people in this room, that we have an opportunity to pass this bill. I'm a realist. The position, of course, of Mohawn, the sportsman's group, started out as a 1/8 bill. It was added when I was carrying the bill, and we included some other entities and all this type of stuff. But I think these things can be worked out. And I know the position of the sportsmen and women of this state, how it started. I compromised when I was carrying this bill with some other groups. Other things came into it. But it's crucial is that, at least from my perspective, and I think the sportsmen of this state, that 1/8 of whatever the total comes out goes to game, fish, and wildlife. That is the linchpin of the support of the sportsmen as a group to whatever comes out. There's some people I know that's a lot of animosity to other things in the bill. There's some of the things in the bill do I like? No. But I'm a realist. And And from whatever part I can do to try to bridge these gaps, I certainly will do so. Whatever little bit of input I have with the sportsmen's groups or how much. So I'll try to work this out with you. And Mr. Shadi, I really appreciate this. I think that what's going to hurt me, I guess, is the one legacy that I wanted to leave in all the years I was in the legislature was passing this 1/8 bill or this a form of this. And I will never be, I was never able to do it. So you people will have an opportunity to do something that I was never able to do in all the years I was here. I think you have a chance to leave a legacy that will be the model for the country. There'll be no other states that even approaching what we have, including Missouri. And I happen to believe in clean water. I have no objection to clean water being part of the bill. I think you can't separate the two from habitat. And but you have a chance to do something that will be a landmark for the country, just like the constitutional amendment for hunting and fish, which Georgia just passed a couple of months ago. So I want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come before you. I chaired this committee, I think, for a decade and a quarter about, so I used to sit up there and I had everybody picking at me. Senator Olson, she was always asked these tough questions that I couldn't answer. And Senator Anderson, she just liked to pick on me, so that was it. I meant that as a compliment.
Just that to all of us.
You got to see what my secretary used to. Oh, God. But okay, I appreciate this very much. Senator Stump, I remember, and all the work we did together, and Senator Fredrickson and Greg, we had so much fun. But anyway, thank you very much. Please pass the bill. Leave a legacy that'll, I guarantee, it'll be nothing like in the country. And you will see other states looking at us as a model.
Thank you,
that's
Senator.
That's the best I can do. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And you kept your head of hair better than some of us did over that decade. Questions?
As a comment.
Okay, thank you.
No questions from me? Do you or the other way around?
Your testimony was perfect.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Ryan Henniger, Ducks Unlimited. There is one person we're going to take out of order because they have to leave very soon. So we'll take Sean Dossie next.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Henniger. I'm the State Conservation Director for Ducks Unlimited. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some brief testimony. I am a waterfowl biologist by trade, but a few years ago I traded in my waders and binoculars for a suit and tie to do this type of work because it's just so important. I'm here today to offer a couple of thoughts, but first of all, I want to thank all the five authors and the co-authors that have introduced legislation related to the conservation of Minnesota's natural resources. I'm confident that the legislative process will provide the opportunity for an open debate and an exchange of good ideas, and in the end, it'll provide and produce a bill that is reasonable and one that can be supported by a majority of Minnesota voters. I also want to provide some encouragement on behalf of the 39,000 members of Ducks Unlimited in Minnesota to make 2007 the year, just as former Senator Lessard just mentioned, 2007 the year that this gets done and passed by the Senate, passed by the House, and agreed on by both bodies. Secondly, and most importantly, I want to touch on the real conservation needs facing Minnesota. A few statistics. Minnesota historically had 20 million acres of prairie, mostly in the western and southern region of the state. Today, that number is less than 1%. And as staggering as that is, that less than 1% is highly fragmented. Its condition is relatively unknown and certainly just a fraction of what it used to be. In that same region of the state, there's less than 20% of the historic wetlands. And of course, with the loss of those wetlands, not only did it have pretty monumental impacts on waterfowl, but other wetland migratory birds, water quality, and flood storage. As you all know, or hopefully know, last year the Department of Natural Resources completed a long-range duck recovery plan. The plan calls for the restoration and protection and enhancement of 2 million acres over the next 50 years of wetlands and grasslands. The primary outcome of this plan will be to increase the number of breeding waterfowl in Minnesota by up to 1 million birds. The plan also calls for the enhancement and the restoration of 1,800 shallow lakes. Shallow lakes are those bodies of water that are sometimes just 3, 5, 10 feet deep. And right now, they're really in the bullseye from a development perspective in Minnesota because all the bigger, deeper recreational lakes are already developed. The total cost for this duck plan is an astounding $3 billion, with a B, dollars. Now, before you fall out of your chair, the state's not going to be on the hook for all of that. It's going to be a partnership effort that's going to involve nonprofit organizations, the federal agencies, local governments. But the state will have to be a major player and a major funder of this plan to be successful. And although this duck plan will be completed under a duck banner, if you will, we all know that habitat is the key for both game species like waterfowl and pheasants and deer, and for non-game. Relatedly, as an example, the DNR also completed a comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy that defines the needs of native animals that are either rare, declining, or vulnerable to decline. The list of species in this plan is 9 pages long. It includes a variety of species, some well-known, such as upland sandpipers, chestnut-collared longspurs, or lesser-known species such as the tiger beetle and the Higgins eye pearly mussel. My point is this. Without sufficient quality and quantity of habitat in Minnesota, the diversity that we have will not flourish or even thrive in the future. The good news is that Minnesota has some of the most passionate and best-trained conservation professionals of any state in the country. The tool that they need more than anything to go forward and do the research, to really pin down and use the science to get the job done, is the funding. And not just for 2007 or 2008, but a long-term commitment by the state to do this. So I would ask that you do your part in helping make the funding package a reality so that these plans can not just sit on a shelf somewhere, but become a reality. I'd be happy to take any questions, and thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, we sat here down in my country and we put together a crap 100 and some thousand acres. I'm a firm believer in perpetual easement. We couldn't pass that. We missed the boat by not doing that. So if it wasn't perpetual, 20 years from now, even less than that, land selling for $5,000 an acre, I'll plow it up. So if we're going to do any of that, we got to have that perpetual. Has to stay tied up. You can't let somebody come in and refarm it.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator Heidegger. Vickerman, I could not agree more. Point well taken.
Yeah, that is an important piece of it. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Heidegger. Sean Dossey?
Sean Dowse. Thank you for moving me up the agenda.
I know you're from out of town and want to make sure that you're able to speak.
Thank you. My name is Sean Dowse. I'm executive director from the Sheldon Theater in Red Wing, Minnesota. I do have some handouts. Thank you for moving me up the agenda. I have to get back to Red Wing to conduct auditions for the High School Musical. I'm executive director.
You can thank hold you some for auditions here if you like.
Thank you for seeing me today. I'm executive director of the Sheldon Theater in Red Wing, Minnesota. That's a 466-seat theater. It was built in 1904 through a partnership with the City of Red Wing and the private sector and the state of Minnesota. The Sheldon presents about 100 events per year. Over half of these events are created locally. Over half of our artists are young people from Red Wing and from the surrounding communities. In 2006, we attracted 28,000 people, 51% of which were from Red Wing, and the remaining 49% came from across the state, came from outside Red Wing, came from across the state of Minnesota, and from west central Wisconsin. As you'll hear later about the economic impact of the arts in any community across Minnesota, the Sheldon, and as you can see from this map, which shows you a zip code profile of ticket buyers outside Red Wing and in Red Wing, that Red Wing is an important partner in Red Wing's visitor tourism industry, attracting visitors and their dollars from across the upper Midwest. I am here to encourage the committee to include arts in the bills that you approve, that you're considering today, because such an amendment, if enacted, will help us sustain our efforts in supporting local arts and the local community. The Sheldon maintains its fiscal operation through a combination of revenue sources. These include ticket sales, individual contributions, local corporate and foundation gifts, local government support, and grants from the state through the Minnesota State Arts Board. For the past 5 to 8 years, we have seen our local corporate funding steadily decrease in Red Wing as Red Wing-based companies have been purchased by out-of-state corporations. In one case, an out-of-state insurance corporation purchased a locally grown insurance company that had given the Sheldon $10,000 a year annually. Within 2 years of the purchase, the local insurance operation was closed. The jobs were lost, along with the support for the arts. In another case, an out-of-state bank bought a locally owned bank that had been around since the early 20th century in Goodhue County. A $10,000 annual contribution became a $5,000 contribution. I consider that a win, actually, but it is still a decrease. In 2003, when the state of Minnesota was dealing with a budget balancing challenge, the state cut funding to the Minnesota State Arts Board and to local governments. For the Sheldon, this was a double whammy. The Arts Board cut funding, and the city of Red Wing was forced to cut its support. Combined with a decline in corporate funding, this has meant a decrease in programming created by local artists that we could support and our ability to present regional and national artists that could attract even more audiences. For example, prior to 2003, we were able to attract over 30,000 people annually to the Sheldon Theater. For instance, in 2000, through a combination of state funding, city local support, we were able to present 4 sold-out performances of the Guthrie's A Midsummer Night's Dream. The production played to school groups from Rochester, Goodhue, Cannon Falls, and Red Wing, to name but a few, and to folks from all around the area. Without the help of the state of Minnesota, the city of Red Wing, with the help of the state of Minnesota, city of Red Wing, and local corporations, we could not have kept the ticket prices at a reasonable $25 top price and $15 student price for that event, because the Guthrie Show we purchased the Guthrie Show for $60,000. At this time, Red Wing is facing also the probability of a utility validation rule change that will further undercut the city's ability to support important services in the future. I am speaking in support of including arts in your bill today in the hope that such an amendment, if it's approved by the citizens of Minnesota, would provide a stable base of sustainable support for our efforts in rural Minnesota so that we can be able to remain a partner in our city's economy and its cultural life. Thank you for hearing me.
Questions for the witness? Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, if arts are included in the amendment, what would you do to help encourage the citizens of the state of Minnesota to vote for the amendment? In other words, are you along just for the free ride, or are you willing to roll up your sleeves and help pass the amendment?
I'll roll up every sleeve I've got in order to help it go. We have, as I say, 25 to 30,000 ticket buyers. We could help contact those folks who have a stake in our success and our ability to deliver arts to the community. I'm a member of the Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, so I will be working hard along with my colleagues.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made reference to City of Red Wing undergoing some utility rules.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Specifically, Xcel has a nuclear plant within the city limits of Red Wing, and the the property tax is going a reevaluation, and so the Xcel will not be, under one scenario, obligated to pay property taxes to Goodhue County and the City of Red Wing at the level they are today. It's going to go way down.
Thank you, Mr. Dowsey. Appreciate your presence here.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
I'm going to revert back to the agenda. Jim Klatt from Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, members of the abiding body here that are here to hear testimony today. I have a few brief comments to make and then talk about a little general thought on this whole process as well. As most of you know, the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance represents most of the hunting and fishing organizations in the state of Minnesota, and trappers and some conservation groups. They're also part of the board of directors. Since the initial bill in 1998, the outdoor community, the hunting, fishing, trapping community, has pretty much said we would like a fund just for us. Philosophically, that hasn't changed. But as I mentioned in an earlier meeting today, there are some confluences of organizations coming together, not just in the state of Minnesota, but nationally, that are great portends for better things for the outdoor community. And I see that happening in Minnesota as well. We still are pretty firmly fixed in the hunting and fishing and trapping community on having a bill that's clean for our outdoor environment. We definitely recognize the need for the art community to have their funding, and we hope that there's a process that this body can go through to make both of those things happen. Now, I was asked specifically to talk about access here today, and that's near and dear to my heart because my full-time real job is with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, which is based in Washington, D.C. We are a national organization representing 1,500 other outdoor hunting and fishing groups, including Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, and the others. And our national focus, which also bears on the state, has to do with access, and it has to do with the things Bob talked about earlier regarding timberlands being snapped up for private use. It has to do with farmland access programs for hunters like the South Dakota Walk-In Access Program. All of those things are very, very important. If you look at land values around the state of Minnesota and the way people are buying land, it's not just the sale of big blocks of timber in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin. It's small parcels that are getting snapped up on Lakeshore and off of Lakeshore for private development and private personal use that at one time or another were open to hunting. And I'll give you a couple of specific examples. My cabin happens to be in northern Wisconsin on the northern end of the Shawamigan National Forest. All around me, besides the National Forest land, there's Bayfield County land. It's very like what's happening in northern Minnesota. Bayfield County sells blocks of 40-acre parcels along rights-of-way and along gravel roads when they need to raise money for deer hunters. And they all of a sudden, you'll have a mile stretch of land that's now individually owned in 40-acre parcels, and no hunting signs go up or no trespassing signs go up on that land. Unfortunately, right behind that is 10,000 acres of county land that now nobody can get to. That's the tip of the iceberg of one of the problems that's happening. If you look at the success of access programs, most of you are familiar with South Dakota's walk-in hunter access, where a farmer is paid X amount of dollars to allow public hunting on their land. 1 million acres is enrolled in South Dakota. It has been for years. Farmers get as much as $7 an acre. And when you look at farmers who also have land in conservation set-aside programs, Conservation Reserve, which is going to be part of the Farm Bill issue this year, they're getting that $7 on top of the set-aside. So they're not only protecting the land and the marsh for Ryan's ducks, but they're getting a little extra bonus with it and as an incentive to keep that land in the program. Now, TRCP is working with all the states and the federal government to set up a matching fund in Washington to help increase the amount of money that can go to those kinds of programs. So there's movement out there to do this, but we're way behind the curve. We talked about the numbers of people moving into the state. They are going to concentrate in Minneapolis, but they're going to go out here looking for something, and all of a sudden they're not going to be able to find it because access is being cut off through the sales of lands to private property, to private individuals, and we need to focus economic strength on solving that problem. And it's not something that can change every year at the whim of the House and Senate because other issues become predominant. We need a firm, dedicated fund to make sure we can have that happen. And it's not just access for hunters or fishermen. It's access for boaters. It's access for bird watchers. It's access for people who like to just hike. It's the snowmobile and ATV trails. All of those things are being negatively impacted by our inability to preserve the land. And I think it's critical that we look at this as a major challenge that the state cannot just duck at this point. We're in against the wall right now, and we're batting our heads against it. And it's not just here. It's national. This is a national issue. We just happen to have probably more resources that are being impacted by this than a lot of other states. You know, if you take a look at North Dakota, the population in North Dakota is actually shrinking. But they have a problem because out-of-state buyers are buying up big chunks of property for private hunting use or private recreation use, and what used to be a place where hundreds of people could go, very few can go. Now, I'm going to conclude this with something that, and I haven't covered everything here, but I know in the interest of time, we need to get through this. Teddy Roosevelt once said, Teddy Roosevelt said a lot of things, and most of you know about Teddy Roosevelt. At TRCP now, because we're focused nationally on all these issues, every time we do something with a state or a federal program, the question we ask is, what would Teddy have done? What would Teddy do if he was faced with this issue of land use absorption into something other than what it was intended to be in the first place? And we look back at what he did, and most of you know the history. In 11 days, he set aside 290 million acres, which we now have as national parks. And bless his little heart, he did it without the House and Senate because he would have been killed if he'd have tried to do it with the House and Senate. He went around, but he got it done. We need that kind of challenging leadership on this issue in this state right now. So that's my case. MOHA will be in this mix to support the issue going forward. We will be meeting with the caucus every other week, and we really appreciate all of your interest in this. Are there any questions?
Questions for Mr. Klatt? Thank you very much. Next on the agenda, John Schwarz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Schwarz. I am the past president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I hope I don't repeat too much of what Mr. Klatt had just said. I didn't really have any prepared remarks, but a brief statement. Back in 1998, when we passed the right to hunt and fish, shortly thereafter, Senator Lessard and then Representative Mark Holston came forward with this conservation idea, came directly to the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and asked that we come on board and support this great idea. Actually, I'm here to take a little credit. We've been at this 10 years. And the ball really got rolling here in the last couple of years, but for a long time, it's been a long and lonely vigil. So on behalf of MOHA, I'd like to take a little credit for helping to keep the idea, the original intent, alive. We're poised now. I'm very encouraged that this is the year to get this thing going. And to reiterate what Jim had just said, MOHA will be here in the mix. Remember where it started. As a habitat issue, whatever comes out of this body, whatever your wisdom reflects, we're certain it will reflect on our habitat heritage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Shores. And next is Joe Dugan, Pheasants Forever.
No, he said in his statement.
Welcome to the committee.
Welcome, or thank you. I just got back from Des Moines. My name is Joe Dugan. I'm with Pheasants Forever. I'm Vice President of Pheasants Forever. This last week, I was down in Des Moines. We had a national convention, and there was people there from all across the country, and including officials from Washington, Senator Harkin, Chairman of the Ag Committee, and Representative Colin Peterson, Chairman of the House Ag Committee. We were on the Des Moines River, and the mayor of Des Moines came to one of our meetings. It was interesting what he talked about is the critical problem Des Moines has. Des Moines has the world's largest, I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, denitrification plant. That is, they take the nitrates, nitrogen out of the water in Des Moines to correct the water problem. Upstream of Des Moines is where the problem lies. It's primarily from agriculture and farming the land, problems that many years ago we didn't know we were going to be facing but have to be dealt with today. The connection point is the land. This bill, authored by Senator Lessard and Representative Mark Holson several years ago, in fact, to your point, Senator Chaudhry, I don't know if you remember, a few years ago I had a full head of hair. Now I'm getting to the point where my hair is as absent as the wetlands for the ducks. But we do have pheasants. But to my point, that's where this all connects, is on the land. And as we treat the land, the water will be corrected. Not entirely, obviously, but so the focus on habitat, the focus on dealing with game, fish, wildlife, those things need to be the core of what comes of this. There's many good ideas represented in these five bills. I'm afraid that a couple things, that it has to pass the citizenry in November 2008. The bill has to be something that the public can support. We know from past experience that the folks in Minnesota support the outdoors. They support fish and wildlife. In fact, the only public ballot taken that really tells a story was about 8-9 years ago. Minnesota passed the Environmental Trust Fund legislation, and in the same year passed the right to hunt, the amendments of right to hunt and fish. And interestingly, the right to hunt and fish, albeit by a very small margin, outpolled the Environmental Trust Fund. These as you said in your first comments, Senator, the heritage that we enjoy here in Minnesota is very important. Not important just for our culture and livelihoods, but it's really growing important. Do we want to put a denitrification plant somewhere along the Mississippi River unneeded? If we take care of the land, if we drive the funds developed from this legislation into the ground to take care of the land, a lot of those problems get taken care of. There's a lot of information you'll hear. There's countless details, and I just wanted to say it on behalf of Pheasants Forever. Our 25,000 members, we got about 70 chapters across the state. We're fully supportive of this legislation that would support dedicated funding for game, fish, and wildlife. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Dugan? Thank you very much.
Very much.
Next, we'll take John Curry and Jeff Hegard together.
Will you go first?
Sure.
Slide.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Hegard. I'm the executive director of an organization called 1,000 Friends of Minnesota. We work for improved land use throughout the state and community planning. In essence, we work on the issues related to rapid growth and its myriad of consequences. We did have a slide that we were going to show today, and it would rotate over and over and over to show you the drama that's playing itself out with our population growth and what it means to the land. It's pretty intense. If you don't know these statistics, you need to, because Minnesota's population is expected to rise to 6.3 million people in the next 25 years. That's approximately 1.2 million more. Minnesota is the fastest growing state in the upper Midwest. In the next 25 years, we will grow by over 28% compared to Wisconsin at 14%, Michigan at 7.6%. Iowa is stagnant, and North Dakota is declining. We are a hub, and our population is growing because we are such an attractive place to live. We can all imagine the good things that come from growth, that come from living in a growing state. We have a strong and vibrant economy. It means jobs and billions upon billions of dollars in construction for the next generation, and that's good. All that we can do to build our economy is part of this discussion. But this growth also comes with a double-edged sword. The most dramatic numbers I can give you are in housing units. If you think back to 1850, when really we started to develop this state, everything around us has been built. All that infrastructure has been developed in the last 150 years. At present, we have somewhere around 1.8 million living units in the state. That's everything from condos to apartments to lake homes to McMansions. In the recent years, we've been constructing new units at a pace of approximately 44,000 a year. That trend is expected to go on for the next 25 years. To accommodate the growing population, we're going to need an additional 1 million living units in the state in the next 25 years. That's quite dramatic when you think of the fact that we have 1.8 right now. That's a huge increase that's going to occur in our lifetimes. We're responsible for how we do it and the impact that it has. These units are going to be built in the 7-county metro area, or 2/3 of these units are going to be built in the 7-county metro area. And the rest are going to be spread from just south of Rochester up through the metro area, up through St. Cloud, through Brainerd and Detroit Lakes. What this means is by 2030, we'll convert another 1 million-plus acres from natural areas for agriculture into developed land. It's huge. We only have 50 million acres in this state. Another 1 million will be gone in the next 25 years before we can blink. That's the land equal to Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Dakota, and Carver combined. So if you imagine that drama playing itself out, you all have to look at yourself and wonder who's leading this process, who's in control. And I hate to tell you, it's the people in this room. You will determine the drama that's going to play out in Minnesota in the next 25 years. Now, we can all imagine the land and the infrastructure that it takes to manage our current population. You look at it every day. If you drive in, whether you're from rural Minnesota or the areas around the metro area, you see the development that's occurred just in the last 5 years. That will continue on and on. No matter what decisions we make as leaders and you make as legislators, no matter what policies you make, this wave is going to occur. It's happening right as we speak. It will forever alter the complexion of the state of Minnesota. The question we must ask is not if it's going to alter the complexion, it's how much. In the next 25 years, we will spend billions upon billions of dollars at local, county, regional, state levels, including federal funding. Most of that infrastructure is going to go into developing, to manage that this wave that we have. Those new roads, sewers, schools, hospitals, police, fire protection, all need to be paid for. At the top of maintain, and that's on top of maintaining all of our aging infrastructure. This growth is going to stress local officials in every community, especially in the growth corridor. Small communities, especially, do not have the resources or the capacity to adequately manage the development that's expected to occur. In addition, we're changing demographically. Our population is aging, and this will put additional pressure on healthcare systems and regional centers and small communities. Healthcare is going to suck up every available dollar in the future. Unless you set aside constitutionally dedicated funding, it won't happen. Lastly, the way we're currently using land is going to permanently scar the state and do unrepairable damage to our environment. No matter what we do, it's going to play itself out. In the next few years, we have a window of time. Minnesota's leaders will need to make some really difficult choices. They're going to challenge you politically, your values about what you feel about land. They're going to threaten people. There will be winners and losers. And this moment in time is yours to grasp. Do you have the guts? Do we have the guts to direct growth away from sensitive areas, away from wetlands, away from the forests, into areas that will be used more securely? And do we have the guts to save money on infrastructure costs? Do we create tougher laws that will permanently protect sensitive areas? Will we enforce those laws? Do we limit development in areas that don't have the groundwater to support individual wells? These are the many questions that we are going to have to answer. There's going to be a lot of people speaking today in more specific terms about the referendum. I want to go on the record for 1,000 Friends of Minnesota in support of this amendment that will permanently change the game. But I want to give you a slightly different angle to consider that this is an argument about land use and about protection of delicate properties. But it's really about future prosperity, our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren. Minnesota has a brand. We're the land of clean, sky-blue waters, green forests, wetlands, clean communities. And if we can pass this referendum, we'll have a chance, a slight chance of saving that brand. And if we don't, the consequences will be forever. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Curry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Curry, and I'm with the Minnesota Campaign for Conservation, which, by way of introduction, is a partnership of organizations that are committed to protecting Minnesota's cherished outdoor traditions through land and water protection. We believe in an all-encompassing coalition of sporting interests, parks and trails interests, environment and water organizations. Over the past 15 months, we've worked with some of the best thinkers and strategists in conservation, in state finance, in voter initiatives, and we've tried to determine what proposals would best serve a long-term vision of conservation in Minnesota. We believe the bills before you today are on the right track, and we particularly want to urge you to consider leveraging these funds through bonding and through challenge grants to local units of government. These are both successful tools in other states. I want to first offer you a statement from our sister organization, the Rally for Conservation, that I passed out to you, chaired by Dave Zentner of Duluth and Lance Ness of Minneapolis. A quick summary of their comments is they say, quote, "We commend the various authors for their understanding of the immense problem that we all face, and we encourage them to carry forward and complete the work that approaches a decade of hard work and concern for our great state's natural resources. As you deliberate these different bills, we stand ready to help you to pass this extremely valuable amendment that the citizens of Minnesota will certainly pass if given the chance." I want to direct my comments to the fact that this is not only a smart decision based on the conservation of this state, but it's smart if you look exclusively in terms of the economic interest of Minnesota. Considering the following points, tourism is a $9.2 billion industry. My arguments are not that conservation helps drive the economy of Minnesota. It's the chief driver of the economic interests of Minnesota. Tourism is a $9.2 billion industry. 87% of tourism is something called pleasure travel, and the top activity of tourists is scenic touring, according to Explore Minnesota. Now, scenic touring is something like looking at the pretty hillside, hoping to see wildlife, enjoying all that nature has to offer. That industry is dependent upon great conservation in the state. hunting, fishing, and wildlife. We heard talk about that a little bit earlier. That's a $4.2 billion industry in this state, very dependent upon strong conservation and coordinating this growth of 1.2 million people, the gobbling up of 1 million acres of land, coordinating that with conservation for a healthy future in Minnesota. Forestry. We heard about the loss of forestry lands. That's an industry dependent upon the land as well, a $4.3 billion industry. And finally, farming is a $2.6 billion industry. As growth patterns develop and they don't take into consideration the conservation of these values, all these industries are extremely at risk. I'll go into it a little bit more, but let me reference the other handout that I have. This is sort of a pop look at data. We have been unsuccessful at getting an aggregate look of what real estate is going on in the state. Perhaps we can get a look at that a little bit later, but it's difficult. So instead, we went to the Star Tribune online two nights ago. How much land was for sale? Not homes, but undeveloped lots, undeveloped property, something that's natural land now and will be developed in the future. And you see, based on areas of the state, $204 billion, Star Tribune online, for sale as of 2 days ago.
Billion or billion?
Billion. You look at Greater Minnesota, it's $47 billion, and on and on. This is why, I'm sorry, let me change one little letter, to a B to an M. Million. Thank you, Senator. Regardless,
Curry,
we're talking about a constitutional amendment.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And I have to apologize for this. I'm looking at the clock. I want to give some time to our non-lobbyist witnesses. So that they don't have to come back on Monday. Would you prefer to wrap up very quickly, or instead I could give you first bat on Monday to continue your discussion? And I would certainly let you rehash what you've said so far.
Senator, I'd be happy to come back, and I will not have to rehash what I had.
Okay.
And I know where you're at. You need to move this along, so I'd welcome however you need to move it along.
I appreciate that, and you certainly score points there. Thank you. Why don't we bring up thank you very much, gentlemen. And we'll hear more from you on Monday. And
thank you, Senator.
For the audience, I think it's becoming very clear we're not going to get through all the witnesses.
Thanks, Chair.
So today, so we will carry over onto Monday. Now give people I want to hear from everyone, and I want to hear that's why I haven't been cutting people off. I'm willing to give more time on this on Monday. And it's possible we may not even get to a vote on Monday because of that. But that's okay. I want to hear from people. The next I want to hear from are Leah Rivamonte and Carolyn Bai. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Carolyn Bai. I'm with the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council, and I'm also a resident of Senator Bulger's district. It's good to be here today, Senator Chaudhry, and representatives of the committee. On my way into work this morning, I stopped to get my hair cut, and I was chatting with the woman who was cutting my hair. And I told her I was coming in today and told her a bit about the bills that are being proposed. And the totally unrehearsed response from her was, well, it only makes sense. Minnesota's arts and resources and natural resources are what sets Minnesota apart from other states. It's what defines us, and you go tell them. So from Greta, that was the message, that it makes sense. Minnesota's quality of life is not about natural resources or the arts. It's about our quality of life is natural resources and the arts. And I would like to encourage you, as you are considering this, to include our artistic resources as a partner in what makes Minnesota the state that it is and recognized for all of these wonderful resources. Minnesota's arts and cultural organizations must maintain a healthy infrastructure if they're going to continue to thrive and to serve Minnesota in so many ways. Through this dedicated funding source, the arts will have the stability they need to ensure a healthy and vibrant communities throughout our state. And this will continue to accrue benefits for all Minnesotans. A great state deserves great art, and Minnesota has it, and we need to do what we can in order to ensure that we have it into the future, that we preserve our resources. Minnesota's major institutions like the Guthrie, St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, Minnesota Orchestra, Penumbra Theater, the Institute of Art, and the Walker are world-renowned artistic resources, and they are our institutions. They are Minnesota's flagship arts institutions. Not only do they directly serve and thrill Minnesota audiences, but they are also important economic contributors themselves, contribute to our tourism industry, and provide national and international visibility for Minnesota as a state with an unparalleled quality of life. The state has a stake in the future of arts organizations, and this amendment is going to help to ensure it. But Minnesota's artistic resources are far broader and deeper than the major institutions that I mentioned to you. There are over 1,600 arts and culture organizations in Minnesota, and our system of the State Arts Board and 11 regional arts councils ensure that arts activities are available in every corner of the state. Whether it's the major institutions or community festivals and concerts, to artists teaching in our schools, or to small professional organizations. Minnesotans value the arts, and the activities of most of these organizations will not happen without a regular investment in our community's arts organizations. My colleagues with the Greater Minnesota Regional Arts Councils tell me that frequently in their communities, the support that they provide, which comes from legislative funds, is the only source of funds beyond earned income for their arts and culture organizations and for their community's artistic quality of life. The revenue from this amendment would be an investment in the cultural life of our citizens in every Minnesota community, an investment that they want. And our arts organizations need the increased revenue in order to provide security for their continued existence. Minnesota citizens want access to the arts. They want it through the major institutions, and they want it in their own community. The state has other reasons for investing in Minnesota's arts and culture, however, and that's because the arts mean business in Minnesota. In 2006, a report funded by the McKnight Foundation called The Arts, a Driving Force in Minnesota's Economy, and I don't know, we had intended to have them copies of the brochure distributed, or they could be to all of you. But in this survey, which was a statewide survey, it found that Minnesota's investment in the arts provided an $11 return for every state dollar that was invested. Every region of the state, and in this brochure, we divide the state into the 11 regions that the regional arts councils cover, no matter how small that region or how rural that region, they all had at least $1 million of economic impact. All totaled, the arts create 22,000 jobs. The arts had an overall economic impact of $839 million and generated $94 million in government revenue. Investing in the arts by stabilizing our arts organizations will continue to provide a good return on your investment. The arts matter to Minnesotans and to Minnesota. The stable resources created through this dedicated funding stream will stabilize our important cultural resources. They will ensure our quality of life and ensure that that our arts organizations continue to contribute to Minnesota's economic prosperity. Investing in the arts provides a good return on investment. It's good policy and it's good business. And one of the questions that was asked of Sean Dowse, one of the previous speakers, was about what sort of assistance the arts community could provide if this amendment were to move forward. And I can tell you that the regional arts councils and Minnesota Citizens for the Arts have contacts of advocates throughout the entire state, in every legislative district, every community, and they are ready. And they want to be a part of this. They are supporters of the environmental piece, and they're supporters of the arts. And together we can make it work.
Thank you. Welcome to the – oh, I'm sorry. There's a question for you, ma'am.
Yes.
By Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I look down that list on – now, not all of them can include the arts in their funding. I think two of the proposals do. But when I look down that list, I don't see the Perpich Center for the Arts, and I'm wondering why that was –
I couldn't answer that question. I guess I'd have to.
It might be a better question for the authors.
For the authors.
Senator Stump. Okay, thank you. And welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and Senators. My name is Leah Rivamonte, and I'm the Executive Director of Banff Lock Center for the Arts, which is a small community arts center in Senator Chaudhry's jurisdiction of Fridley, Minnesota.
And this center is, just so everyone knows, this is kind of the birthplace of Fridley along the Mississippi River.
Yes, yes.
Abraham Fridley had a had a general store along the river right where the Banff Lock Center for the Arts is located. And he was elected to the territorial legislature and representing the area of Manoman. That's what it was called, Manoman. So then he got elected to the legislature and then named it after himself, Fridley. And that's the birthplace of Fridley. And just so you know, I have no intentions on changing the name again after myself. Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Ironically, or not ironically, I think Banff Lock Center for the Arts is a perfect example of how the arts and nature can come together and work together. I'm here, again, to support the idea that arts be included in your amendment today. It's also Banff Lock Center for the Arts is in Fridley, but it's also in a park. It's in Anoka, and it's Anoka Park System, Manoman Park, which is an award-winning park, and I see that the director of Anoka County Parks and Rec is here today. And it's an absolutely glorious place in which one can experience both the beauty of nature, where Rice Creek and the Mississippi come together, and the arts inside of this historic building, where we have gallery space, classes and workshops. We have artist residencies. We have a small gift shop, which features local artists' work. What do we do for the community? Well, we offer opportunities for individuals and families of all socioeconomic, cultural, and ethnic backgrounds. That's an important thing to remember. It's small community arts centers are not don't offer the special Saturday night outings that perhaps the Guthrie does. Instead, we try and incorporate arts into the daily life of all the citizens and make art accessible to all. I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of, and they aren't earth-shaking examples, but they are examples of how the small things sometimes in life give shape to life and give meaning to life. We partner with an organization, a small drop-in center called Bridgeview, which is a drop-in center for people who suffer from debilitating mental illness. We we help them show their work. They have an art program in which people suffering from depression or bipolar affliction can learn the techniques of painting and drawing, and we exhibit the work of those people. Now, that seems not like a huge thing, but to these people, it's immense. It gives someone who cannot get out of bed some sort of inspiration to do that. It gives them self-worth, and it gives them a language in which to express themselves that makes sense to them. And it also lets other people give them a sense of dignity and respect that they may not have otherwise had. Here's another example. At Banful Luck, we have a reading series every second Friday of the month. We partner with another arts organization. Because we're a small organization, we do partnerships with a whole lot of other organizations, both civic and cultural. At Banful Luck, an example, something that moved me, an older white woman, listens to the poem of a young African-American man, someone whom she would never have had the opportunity to even speak to or the courage to even speak to, and asks him about the details of his poem. And we're also moved by his answer, but especially by her question. This is an example of how arts can make a difference in people's lives and bring people together. When you see a child's face screwed up in fierce concentration, looking very carefully at a photograph or a painting that they're trying to find a clue in, we have an art treasure hunt that gives them clues to look for specific things. They work with their parents and their guardians and their siblings to find the answers to these clues. They're looking very deeply at these works of art. They're finding some meaning outside of themselves. That's how art is a tool for bringing people together, for helping people to learn about the world, for seeing beyond differences, and for communicating beyond facts. As I say, these aren't earth-shaking examples, but that's part of what makes art an incredibly special, important, vital thing, and enhances all of our communities, brings us all together, just as the outdoors does. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Tom Jess will be our last witness for today. Mr. Jess, we have another committee coming in, and we still have to clean up our end of it. So
I understand.
Welcome,
Chairman,
to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Tom Jess. I'm a private citizen. I live in Plymouth, and I followed this as an interested citizen over the years. I'm not going to mince words. We had this legislature after last year, and I actually went, and what was going on in the House, I actually called it a circus. I hope that this body that was elected this past year, meaning Senate and House, is going to come together and actually do something for the people of Minnesota. The time for all the posturing is over, okay? You got to be able to put a bill that's going to make sense to the people in the state. If I look at Senator Pogemiller's bill, I have some questions because on lines 921 to, or I'm sorry, 926 to 929, it looks like as soon as this bill hits the legislature, there's going to be money diverted somewhere else. I don't know if it's going to be in lieu of taxes, because for fiscal year 2001, it's taking language that's out of the bill, 97%. For fiscal years 2002 and 2003, 87%. And for fiscal year 2004 and thereafter, 72.43% of the revenues, including interest penalties, transmitted to the commissioner under section whatever. Okay? I hope that this is not going to be something that was done with the lottery, because the people need to know, is the money going to be dedicated to the purposes that it's being advertised. If you're not going to do it, you better not put it in front of the voters, because they're going to take and tell you to, you know, put it somewhere. I have one grandson. I just found out I'm going to be a grandfather for the second time. I'm not going to live to see what their children's children get to see in this state, but we've got 150 years of evidence of what we've done to the state. We need to do something. I'm in support of Senator Chaudhry's bill. I've told my senator, Bonhoeff, that I support that bill, and I've urged her to support Senator Chaudhry's bill because it puts the money where we need it. We need it in the outdoors, okay? And we need to, if you're going to include the arts, then you better do something else, because people in outstate Minnesota are going to look right through it, mainly because the arts have about an $839 million impact, where they said the outdoors is $4.2 billion. That's 5-1. In the bills that are right now, you're putting 1.5-1. 1.5 for the outdoors for every dollar that you're going to give to the arts. People, this isn't, it's not rocket science. People can look at those numbers and say, my economic impact, and that's throughout the whole state of Minnesota, that $839 million, 80% of it is within 40 miles radius of this building. We've got to do something. And we've got to have a sensible bill that will be able to go before the people, make sense, and get them to vote in affirmation. If need be, you look at what happened after last year's session. For 2 weeks straight, we saw the Guthrie Theater, the Minnesota Institute for Arts, and this one other one that I can't think of right now, were all paraded on the front page of the Star Tribune. Are the arts really in trouble? Because I think the Minnesota Institute of Arts had a $100 million raised $103 million schedule. Are the arts really in that much trouble? Mr. McGuire from United Health made $10 million for the park that's right next to the Guthrie. If we're going to do something for Minnesota, let's actually give the people something that they can look forward to and enjoy over the years. The other thing is clean water. You drive by lakes every time. 40% of all sampled lakes, rivers, and streams don't meet PCA standards. That means 2 in every 5. Minnesota has close to 15,000 bodies of water. 10 acres or larger, that means that's 6,000. We need to put some money into cleaning this environment up, or we as Minnesotans aren't going to be here very long. And I hope that, and pray that this body look at the data, consider it, and come up with a bill that will actually service the people of Minnesota. Thank
you. Questions for Mr. Jess? Thank you very much for being here. And I want to thank the rest of the folks who meant to testify today for their patience. We will have you on Monday, and we'll take the rest of the testimony. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, you don't have a save file in our folders, but would you, will you leave the things that we leave in our folder in rather than take them out?
I'm informed that our folders will not be cleared after today's hearing. So if you put it in your folder, it'll be saved until next hearing.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Thank you very much, and meeting's adjourned.